White Aryan Resistance calling. White Aryan Resistance calling. This is the White Aryan Resistance Radio Network. Your host for today's show is Tom Metzger, Terrible Tommy. So get a spot of tea, sit down and relax, because it's time for another show on the White Aryan Resistance Radio Network.
Actually, it's Lone Wolf Radio, Metzger. Can't you get that straight through your head? Okay, boys and girls, here's another shoe. I started this show 3 times and I got disturbed or cut off or screwed up. I hope this is a charm. The 3rd time should be the charm. And it is May the 19th. 2017, Freya's Day. That's right. Today I'm going to spend some time on this Middle East thing and Trump going over there like an idiot, selling more arms to Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia, if we have an enemy, it's Saudi Arabia. And on this show I'm going to run, they said at one point the Saudi Arabians aren't nearly as smart as the Iranians. Well, that's easy to know that. Iran is what's left of the Persian Empire, and there are many, many Aryans and white people in that population, whereas the Saudi Arabians, they're just a bunch of goat herders that got sort of like the Beverly Hillbillies that kicked the dirt and got oil coming out. The Americans went over there and developed their oil for them. They just sit back, collected the money, and got whatever. So these Saudi Arabians should be taken out of the picture. And Trump is an idiot for going over there. Of course, not for the reasons I think, because he's doing it for the military-industrial complex. And boys and girls, it's money. You must understand. Don't listen to these right-wingers or left-wingers that go on and on about peace and this and that and going to protect the United States. No, it's all about money and the arms business. And you don't have to be left or right to understand that. And so I'm going to run this show for you. I listen to this show quite frequently because it brings together some pretty sharp cookies from the Middle East and the United States, too. Basically, against the war, these wars and so forth like that, and understand the chicanery and crookedness of our leaders. I mean, downright filthy, dirty, rotten leaders. And so when you hear me cuss them out and say they're no good and rats, I believe it. And I can't support any of them. I can't support a senator or a congressman or a president or any federal courts or state courts or anything like that. I'm sorry, that's just the way it is, boys and girls. So here we go.
Hello. Foreign destinations include Saudi Arabia and Israel. On the campaign trail, he was highly critical of Washington's military adventurism in the Middle East. Now it appears he's saying quite the opposite. Be prepared for wars Trump once condemned. Saudi Arabia, I'm joined by my guest, Riaz Karim in London. He is the director of Veritas Center for Strategic Studies. Also in London, we have Mahan Abedin. He is a writer and Iran analyst at Middle East Eye. And in Tehran, we cross to Mohammed Mirandi. He is an associate professor at the University of Tehran. All right, gentlemen, crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump in anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. Mahan, if I can go to you first in London. As I pointed out in my introduction, we had a candidate Trump, and now we have a president. President Trump, and he has very different views, particularly on the Middle East now. His trip to Saudi Arabia, we're being told, has about $100 billion military contracts involved in it. There's talk that it could be much, much higher than that. What accounts for Trump's change of mind? Is this about face? And what is all that military hardware for? Go ahead, in London, Mahan.
Yep. Well, to be fair, there's always a gap between what a politician promises to do during the campaign period and what they actually set out to do when they've achieved power. But I think in Trump's case, the gap is just very big.
Yeah.
Because, he fought a campaign on the grounds of avoiding conflict in the Middle East, of trying to extricate the United States away from tension points in the Middle East, and yet he's actually really dived into the deep end during the first 3 or 4 months of his presidency. We saw the attacks on Syria in early April, and we've also seen a very stepped up U.S. involvement in Yemen. I think that's a very important point. During the Obama presidency, even though the United States is formally committed to the Saudi-led coalition which is bombing Yemen, the United States mostly did not engage in kinetic action against Yemeni forces, either the army allied to Ali Abdullah Saleh or the Houthi movement. But under Trump, that has changed. And also in relation to the arms deal that you just mentioned, yes, that's important, but you see, Saudi Arabia is a country that's been absorbing tens of billions of dollars of Western hardware for at least 35 years. There's a precedent to that. The British arms deal, the so-called Al-Yamama arms deal, which goes back to the 1980s, which Margaret Thatcher signed with the Saudis. That arms deal, by the way, hasn't fully expired. There's elements of it which are still ongoing. And yet the Saudis have now embarked on a new arms deal with the United States. It's a case of absorbing hardware. But the real issue is that Saudi Arabia does not really have the capacity to use this hardware to its advantage, because its military structurally is very weak. It has little capacity. They have very little training. A very weak military ethos.
One thing we've seen...
In essence, Saudi Arabia...
Well, that's clearly been borne out by this. It's an unnecessary conflict with Yemen. Let me go to Karim. I mean, as Mahan pointed out, and we've had all of these arms deals over the last few decades here, and now there's the mother of all arms deals is coming about. I mean, Saudi Arabia is not threatened really by anyone, so what do they need all of this armament for? Okay, the conflict in Yemen. There's another country in the greater Middle East, I think you know what I'm talking about. They would, and there's been some really hard talk directed to Tehran. I mean, it seems to me those are two easy dots to connect. Go ahead.
Yeah, they are easy dots to connect. See, Saudi Arabia has to flex its muscle to Iran and the rest of the Middle East, because they have a twofold situation going on. Number one is the Iran situation, which is very unnerving for them, because Iran is the white elephant that everybody likes to scare, but nobody likes to touch. And then you have the spread of their Wahhabi doctrine, which also takes precedence. So when you combine the two, they need the military muscle to do that, or so they should be able to show that they are mighty. But this thing has so many facets to it. It's not only that, because in 2016, Saudi Arabia came out and said they would flog $750 billion worth of treasuries and other assets if they were found liable for the 9/11 attacks. Damage control had to be done right there and then, and this is the result. What you're seeing right now is the damage control that is being done because of that.
Okay, well, let me go to Tehran here. That's appeasement in my mind here. Okay, that's appeasing the Saudis here. I mean, again, looking at this military hardware and Riyadh's foreign policy in general, disaster in Syria, disaster in Yemen, saber rattling as usual with Iran. They're just doubling down on failure in my mind here. I mean, just because you have the hardware doesn't mean you're going to be able to have the means and the capability to be able to be effective, because they have all this hardware anyway, and they are ineffective completely. Go ahead, Mohammed, in Tehran.
I think there are a couple of important things to keep in mind. One is that the Saudi family, obviously, by purchasing these huge amounts of weapons during the last few decades, during the Obama years, records were broken, and possibly now new records will be broken. By doing so, they feel that the United States will protect the ruling family. Not Saudi Arabia, but I think the ruling family, because Saudi Arabia is under no threat from any foreign power. The war in Yemen is something that the Saudis themselves initiated, and the resistance against the Saudis in Yemen has not gone deep inside Saudi Arabia itself.
Right.
The war, of course, is a failure, and that shows that, as pointed out, that all this hardware is really of no use to the Saudi regime. The only thing that they're doing is that they're bombing Yemen. The Saudi army has shown itself to be utterly incompetent. So all this hardware is basically being stored until it becomes useless in a couple of decades. Another point I think that's important is that the Saudi royal family, they make a lot of money through these businesses, through the purchasing of these weapons. They get the kickbacks. So, and of course, many people in the United States do. So the family becomes more rich, certain princes become more rich, certain allies in the United States become more rich, and the Saudi people lose huge amounts of money. And the Americans do not sell to the Saudis with, you know, they don't give them discounts.
No.
In fact, the Saudis could buy Russian weapons or Chinese weapons that could do the same thing at a much, much lower price. But that's not the purpose. The purpose is the kickbacks and to keep the American government happy. But is the American government going to do anything for the Saudis, to do their work for them? I doubt it. They will support them as they are in Yemen to help with the blockade, to help with the bombing. Just on Wednesday, a large number of civilians were again massacred by the Air Force, the Saudi Air Force. We see cholera breaking out, mass starvation being forced upon the Yemeni with the support of the Americans. That is something that's been going on for the last two or three years. But the Americans are not going to fight the Saudis' wars for them. In fact, I think the Americans would actually like to have Iran around, because a country like Iran gives the Americans the opportunity to rip off the Saudis.
Okay, that's a very interesting point. But there's a lot of people that say the crown prince that is running Saudi Arabia, that he's politically very unstable, he's impulsive, he's gone on this adventurous foreign policy that has been absolutely disastrous, and from reports I've seen is that he's not even aware of it. There's no such thing in his mind of a failure. I mean, he just keeps doubling down on it, and they're absolutely overwhelmed, the Saudi family, that Trump is so openly friendly with them and to continue their foreign policy adventures. And I want to talk about sectarianism in the second half of the program. This is a concern, the nature of the regime in Riyadh right now. Go ahead, Mahan, in London.
Yeah, that's a good question. But before I address that, let me just address a technical point about these arms sales. You see, a lot of this money actually goes back to the American contractors, because billions of dollars are spent on servicing, on training. And I can tell you, because I've studied the Al-Yamama deal very closely, that was the British deal forged in the 80s between Margaret Thatcher's government and the Saudis. You know, a lot of that money actually went into companies connected to the British defense establishment. So, you know, we shouldn't think that it's all just hardware going to the Saudis. But that's just a technical point. So it's enriching the American military-industrial complex.
Yeah.
But on your question, you're absolutely right. You see, the new leadership in Saudi Arabia, when the new king took over, Salman, they are very inexperienced. And I think they've tried to compensate for that lack of experience by being aggressive, by going on the offensive. But of course, Saudi Arabia has no experience of doing that. It has no strategy in the region. It doesn't have a credible diplomacy like Iran has, for instance. They don't have an indigenous strategizing processes in their country to produce and execute credible foreign policy.
Can I ask you a quick question?
Yeah, please.
Let me ask you a quick question, because it's really important here. Who were you describing, the crown prince or Trump?
Yeah, that's a fair point. But I think as far as the Saudis are concerned, this new administration is very inexperienced, and they're making mistakes left, right and center. Of course, the war in Yemen is a huge mistake. It's a war the Saudis, and to a lesser extent the Emiratis, they cannot win this war. And the more they bomb Yemen, the more complex the situation becomes underground, and the more untenable their campaign becomes. And I also tentatively agree with your guest in Tehran that the United States, of course, will never do Riyadh's work for them. In fact, the Americans never do anybody's work for them. You know, they're much smarter than that. But I think the danger here is that by closely aligning with Saudi Arabia, as Trump is doing, at least in certain fields, like for instance with Yemen, this has the danger of actually escalating tensions and producing unintended consequences, because the resistance in Yemen, they may very well feel, you know, obliged to strike at American assets, as they tried to do, I think, several months ago by striking at U.S. shipping, because the United States now is an active player.
Okay, gentlemen, I'm going to jump in here. We have to go to a hard break, and after our short break, we'll continue our discussion on Saudi Arabia. Stay with our team. Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter LaBelle. To remind you, we're discussing Saudi Arabia. Okay, I want to go back to Karim in London. You know, gentlemen, it's wonderful to talk about real news and not this fake, you know, Russiagate coming out of the U.S. It's a pleasure to talk about something real. Karim, you know, one of the things that has been talked about over the years, and I've been told that Trump may have it in one of his briefcases, is a Arab NATO or a Sunni NATO, in which the United States wouldn't be a member of, but it certainly would have an enormous amount of influence. And I guess, again, that would be directed against Iran. Speak to this sectarianism that is being fueled on by the Saudi regime to spread all through the region, and we've seen the effects in Syria, the very deadly effects in Syria and elsewhere. Speak to that issue there, please. Go ahead.
Yeah, well, Donald Trump is supposed to take a template with him about this very issue to Saudi Arabia when he visits there on the 20th. That is one of the things that he wants to put through to Salman. This is a very, very dangerous precedence that they're setting right now, because you know, on one side he is going to make a speech on Islam. That is like going into a strip club and saying that, you know, I'm just there to check the quality of the underwear. Come on, you cannot do that. You know, and then the second thing is he wants to get that alliance together. That alliance is already existing. They're bombing Yemen at this point. And you know, they just want to make it official now, that, you know, so that they can sell more arms and ammunition. You know, peace doesn't make money, war does. And you know, the ultimate king is the dollar. It's a very, very dangerous precedence, and it's basically going to keep the Middle East fragmented for a very, very long time. And it's only going to get worse from here if that happens.
You know, Mohammed, you know, reflecting on what we just heard there, I mean, that's exactly what they want. They want to continue the status quo. And the status quo is disastrous for people on the ground, but plenty of people make money off of it. We've all agree on that. But, you know, we have this type of regime in Riyadh right now with a whole lot of money, a whole lot of weapons, seeing failure after failure. And just like Mr. Trump throwing those Tomahawk missiles, the Crown Prince has to show, you know, for his domestic consumption and his family, most importantly, that he's in charge, okay? And this blistering attack against Iran, which is nothing new, but it has a new variant because it's, again, using this sectarian language. Go ahead, Mohammed, in Tehran.
Well, one of the extraordinary things that we're seeing is that in the Western media, the Western media, which is silent about the rise of cases of cholera in Yemen and starvation, and they're silent about the fact that the head of Al-Qaeda in Yemen has admitted that they're fighting alongside American-backed forces in the country against the Ansar Allah or the Houthis and so on. So they're silent about that. But what they are saying is that they're trying to represent Saudi Arabia as the representative of Sunni Islam. And I think that's a huge injustice to Sunnis across the world, because Saudi Arabia basically promotes Wahhabism, the same ideology that Al-Qaeda in Yemen promotes, the same ideology that Al-Qaeda in Syria promotes, the same ideology that ISIS uses. All these different groups, along with Boko Haram and others, they have a similar ideology as that of Saudi Arabia. That is Wahhabism, and that is not mainstream Sunni Islam. But the United States and in Europe, media outlets that are close to the government, the mainstream media, they have a vested interest, as well as think tanks, to show Saudi Arabia as the representative of the Sunni world. Not only is this sectarianism that is being promoted by Saudi, Qatari, and other governments that are oil-rich in the Persian Gulf region, not only is this narrative being promoted by them, sectarianism, which dehumanizes the people of Yemen and justifies the massacre of the people of Yemen. They also use Iran as a scapegoat to justify, you know, the mass starvation of the people of that country. But in addition to that, what they do is they give Muslims across the world a bad name, mm-hmm. because people see Saudi Arabia in the West, many, as representative of mainstream Islam, which it isn't. And then when they see the terrorist activities in Europe, in Paris, in Brussels, and across the world, then they attribute it to ordinary Muslims, sure. in England who are, or in France or in Germany, who are taxpayers, who live like everyone else, who have families, and who are, you know, loyal to their own nations. Increasing hatred.
Let me go back to Mohammed in London. I mean, one of the interesting things again is that, you know, Trump was talking about fighting ISIS, defeating ISIS, and he's visiting a country that has given ISIS and those kinds of groups oxygen to breathe, to survive. I mean, there are people in the administration that have to understand that, though it wouldn't be politically correct to do it, because there's so much money to go around. And their domestic political agendas in Saudi Arabia, and of course Trump has to worry about his problems back home. I mean, are they just blinded by this, or this thing they can just somehow finesse it? Because it doesn't take much effort to find out the connections between Saudi Arabia and other Gulf countries and these terrorist groups fighting in Syria. Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, first, I don't think it's a question of representation, because at the end of the day, you can ask who does represent Sunni Islam. Is it Al-Azhar in Egypt? So that's a red herring. It's not really a question of representation or reputational damage for the global image of Islam. I think these are moot points. But you raise a very interesting issue, Peter, in the case of, you know, the Americans actually willfully ignoring certain basic facts. And we see that also in Syria, for instance, yeah. where the United States is supporting a wide range of groups with, you know, with terrorist intentions, not just in terms of the jihadist constituency, but also with the PKK, you know, or the PKK variant in Syria, the YPG and the rest. So, I mean, the United States has formed in that, this hypocrisy, double standards in the so-called war on terror. Yeah. You know, they are, you know, good terrorists if they are terrorists. But, you know, I think also the United States is in a real quandary in the region now, because broadly speaking, if you look at the strategic landscape, the U.S. influence in the region is in fact decreasing. Right. And I think Trump is anxious to arrest that process or to reverse it. But it's very difficult because, you know, you have a power like Iran, for instance, the predominant power in the region, with a credible strategy, with ample resources at a diplomatic level, the political level, even at the military level, you know, being able to execute a certain project. And going back to Saudi Arabia, there's really nothing the Saudis can do to counter this, because they don't have a strategy of their own. That's the point to be made here. They can spend as much money as they want, but because they lack that strategizing capacity, because they don't have a credible diplomacy, and because, most important of all, because they don't have an authentic narrative, You know, we keep saying Saudi Arabia is Wahhabi. We can go on about that for until the end of time. But the point is that, you know, Saudi Arabia as a nation state, as a regional power, it doesn't have a credible narrative to counter the Iranian narrative. That's why they make mistakes after the other.
They do have a narrative here. If I go to Karim, you know, Secretaries Mattis and McMaster are traveling with the president. And what's really interesting here is that Mahan brings up a very interesting point. I mean, you know, to self-dilute yourself, knowing what the origins of terrorism and the connections between Saudi Arabia and what's happening in Syria and elsewhere. But there's something that blinds all of them, and it's their hatred of Iran. They are willing to turn a blind eye to all of these tragic things and very difficult truths because they have a blind hatred for Iran. And I think that's what it gets down to. Go ahead.
Yeah, that is very true. You know, Iran in itself has shown an incredible amount of restraint so far. You know, even though the Crown Prince went out and said we're going to take the war inside Iran's borders, has made all kinds of you know, statements just to intimidate Iran. But Iran, on the other hand, has shown an incredible amount of restraint, and that is what is bugging them as well. Now we're talking about a country that has such surveillance powers that they can count the hairs on a grasshopper's leg. How can they miss 150 trucks, a convoy of 150 ISIS trucks that are going by freely? You know, that is a question you need to ask yourself. Now, there is another thing that is also in the equation that people are not talking too much because they tend to keep quiet and let this play out itself, and that is Israel. You know, because America, on one hand, has promised Israel that it is going to be the most powerful player in the region. Now, any time they sell arms to Saudi Arabia,
they are
going to have to go back to Israel and give them concessions.
Mahan, I go to you here. I mean, again, it's kind of a knock-on effect. It's an arms race here because you have the Saudis, then you have the Israelis, and then you have other countries in the region that feel like they have to match or keep up. I mean, this is a senseless arms race that is unnecessary.
Iran will never enter into an arms race. They're much more clever than that. You see, if you look at the Iranian defense budget, it's the lowest in the region, bar Yemen. Yeah, but at the same time, despite having a very low defense budget, Iran has very credible military forces because it relies on indigenous capacity, it relies on military leadership, it relies on a credible ethos, and also an indigenous arms industry to keep going. And you know, despite all the sanctions that are imposed on Iran in terms of trying to restrict the country's defense capability, Iran is still the main power in the region in terms of its military. And I think if the Saudis are ever foolish enough to actually, I don't think they are, but let's say, you know, if they make that dreadful mistake of following through with their words and trying to do something silly, I think they would get a very robust response.
I'm sure they would. Gentlemen, I have to jump in. Here we have run out of time. Fascinating discussion. We'll see what happens next.
Now, if the right wing, the honest people in the right wing, would listen to this kind of stuff more often, they'd know what the hell they're talking about. Because all of these congressmen and senators are beholden to the arms industry, and they'll do about anything to get these arms factories into their area, into their system, into their bailiwick, and just for the money that they spread around. So it's really a sick situation. And do you hear anybody much at the top of the Democrat Party or the Republican Party saying we have too many arms and we're building too many armaments and too many bombs? No, they say that's the radical fringe. The radical fringe doesn't want to have war. Well, we know one thing. War is not good for the white race. And we've had several wars that have annihilated thousands and thousands of white people. Same time, annihilating thousands and thousands, maybe millions of non-white people in their countries. If you're going to be a white racist or a white racial separatist, you got to look at all the angles. You got to be honest about it. because the same people that are screwing these people in these other countries and bombing the shit out of them would do it to you if you get too far out of line, just like they did it to the South. The North did it to the South in the Civil War. I got a question for you. Do you ever think something smells about this whole N-word thing? And I don't mean how many Jews died or how many Jews were in the concentration camps. I mean the smell behind all of that. What I'm talking about is I have an opinion based on some facts. I keep looking for more facts. That the thing behind that whole thing with the Jews and the N-word and all, not the N-word, but the J-word, was a war between the Zionists and the non-Zionists. And I think it was mostly the non-Zionists that were getting killed and butchered. The Zionists wanted to get people over to Israel, and they wanted to use all kinds of horror stories and everything else to do it. There's a book called Israel, Hitler, the Father of Israel, and most of the right wing poo-pooed it. I didn't poo-poo it. I think everybody should read that book, because there's, as time goes on, sooner or later they're going to, I think, uncover the real story behind all that stuff in World War II. And I believe the basis of it was a war between the Zionists and the non-Zionists. And I don't know what you think, but I don't have a lot of proof about that, but I think that if you dig deep enough, you'll find it out. You add in the mistakes that Hitler made, and then you've got a real Donnybrook. New movie coming out, it is out, I believe, called Dunkirk, and how the British saved thousands of their troops at Dunkirk from being captured, because Hitler was so foolish that he did not capture them. He had plenty of time to capture that whole army and would have probably brought the war to a stop, but he didn't do it because of his idiosyncrasies and so forth, and his relying on astrologers, you know, like the Clintons. Ronald Reagan and his wife, they're all into astrology, and so they're basing their actions on astrology. Well, that's nonsense, but many top leaders have relied on that kind of Ouija board politics. I think I read someplace where they tried to get Hitler up when that Dunkirk thing was going on, and he didn't want to get out of bed. He was asleep and didn't want to be disturbed. I think we should keep our eye on the money and who's got the money and who's ripping off everybody and so forth like that, instead of just yelling Jew, Jew, Jew and things like that. I think we should stick to that. Who is the crook? Who's taking the money? And you'll find out if there's, when there's crooked Jews, you're going to see it because they're getting the money. So all you have to do is follow the money. And here's Saudi Arabia that couldn't fight their way out of a paper bag, bombing the hell out of Yemen. Yemen's about the poorest country in the world. And here's these rich potentates over there in Saudi Arabia bombing them. It's a sick situation. And here is Trump saying, you know, how he wants to fight terrorism, when we know that the terrorists were coming out of Saudi Arabia that were involved in the 9/11 situation, at least partially. And so, what are you going to do? So he's saying how he wants to get rid of all the people that are against the United States, but yet he's going over there tomorrow to sit down and shake hands with those filthy bastards. It's enough to gag a maggot, boys and girls. And can you imagine Trump appointing Lieberman to the head of the FBI? He's about the last person in the world that should be the head of the FBI. Number one, he's incompetent. He never had any history of law enforcement at all. And it's just another Jew that Obama's going to, I mean, not Obama, but Trump is appointing. To get to the point where they're all Jews. They're all Jews. And I still hear right-wingers and right-wing conservatives and even right-wing racists that support Trump. That don't make any sense at all if you know the facts. That doesn't make you support Hillary Clinton, of course. I think about everybody hated her. But Trump is proving himself to be not a friend of the white working class. Unless you want to work in an arms factory building all kinds of weapons to kill people around the world, if you want that, you can do that, and there are plenty of Americans that are doing it right now. When I worked for Douglas Aircraft years ago, we were building those missiles, possibly to drop on Russia, and in the long run, that was ridiculous. Nuke a source of the white race in Russia. You know, we like genocide against our own people. You notice that? They can't see straight. They can't see the program straight of what they're doing. Bomb Germany, kill Germans, kill Russians. Germans killing English back and forth. It's all genocide of your own race. Well, that's about it for today. I'm a little burnt out on listening to all this stuff and this jazz about Trump going over to the Middle East. So I'm going to hang up my hat and relax, maybe have a drink or two. I'll be back with you on Monday, and maybe I'll be a little more refreshed and a little more positive. It's hard to be positive in a negative world, you know that? When everybody, the media and everybody's lying all the time. Whether it's the banking system, whether it's the legal system, whether it's any of that stuff. They lie all the time. And it's so obvious that they're lying. But yet people, I hear the right wing and left wing in these radio shows going at each other. They don't even have the balls to go on the same show and have the right left work it out. They've got their separate shows. And one side says, yeah, 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 and the other side says, yeah, 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 yeah. They're a bunch of cowards, no balls. You know, whether it's Hannity and these guys on the right, you know, or forget his name, but anyhow. And on the left, you got all these guys on the left screwing around and yelling and screaming and screaming at the right. Nothing's going to change as long as that is going on. If we can just encourage them to kill each other, that would be okay. And we might get someplace. Sayonara, boys and girls.
I'm in a position to know because the Patrick Henry Society has studied the whole thing. The real problem, whether you like it or not, is whether you're going to sit back and let desegregation spread throughout the entire South. And it's an indisputable fact that there could be no other result. The Negroes will literally, and I do mean literally, control the South. The vote will be theirs. You'll have black mayors and black policemen the way they do in Chicago and New York already. Like there's not a black governor and black doctors to deliver your babies. If they find time, that is. And that's the way it'll be. Did you ever stop to think about that? When you let those 10 enter your school, did you?
And everyone wants to tell you their stupid bullshit. And some of them don't know when to stop talking. Those are the dangerous ones, the ones that don't know when the conversation is over. They just go on and on and on and on and on, verbal diarrhea running at the mouth. And dumb shit, stupid shit, trivial shit, shit you're not even remotely interested in.
Did I tell you about my mom and dad? Did I tell you about my mom and dad were down on vacation, this is about 6 years ago, I think, down in Mammoth Cave, Kentucky. I think it was six. Seemed like six. Could have been seven. Somewhere in there. Six, seven, in that area. More than six, less than seven. Let's call it six and a half. So about 6.5 years ago, my mom and dad went on vacation down in Mammoth Cave, Kentucky. You know, now that I think of it, it seems more like 8 years ago. I think about eight would be about the time of Y2K, wouldn't it? Remember that? Remember Y2K? When nothing ever happened. What was that all about? All of a big fuss and nothing ever happened. Anyway, so about 8 years. Eight was eight or five, one of those. And my dad found a big rock, what he thought was a big rock, and turns out it was a 27-pound dinosaur turd. A petrified dinosaur turd, and he gave it to my mom. He said, "Here, Mom, put this. This is a dinosaur turd. Put this in your purse." And she said, "Dad, I don't think this is a dinosaur turd. This thing is still warm. Whoever dropped this thing is still walking around in here, and we better get the fuck out of this cave." I know it was nine, because my wife was pregnant with our first son, Mahmoud Ibn El-Said Ben Salam. And he's 10 now. Or is he 11? He could be 11. He's either 11 or 5. But while all this is going on, you're searching through your mind for something graceful and diplomatic you can say to bring the conversation to a close. And all I can ever come up with is, "Shut the fuck up! Shut the fuck up! Shut the fuck up! Shut the fuck up!"
Tell the truth. Don't be bullshitting people. Like I say, there's enough bullshit as it is. In fact, there's just enough. Did you know that? There's just enough bullshit in this country to hold things together. Bullshit is the glue that binds us as a nation. Where would we be without our safe, familiar American bullshit? Land of the free, home of the brave, the American dream. All men are equal, justice is blind, the press is free, business is honest, the good guys win, your vote counts, the police are on your side, God is watching you, your standard of living will always improve, and everything is going to be just fine. The official national bullshit story. I call it the American okey-doke. Every one of those items is provably untrue at one level or another, but we believe them because they're pounded into our heads from the time we're children. That's what they do with that kind of thing. Pounded into the heads of kids because they know the children are much too young to be able to muster an intellectual defense against a sophisticated idea like that. And they know that up to a certain age, children believe everything their parents tell them. And as a result, they never learn to question things. Nobody questions things in this country anymore. Nobody questions anything. Everybody's too fat and happy. Everybody's got a cell phone that'll make pancakes and rub their balls now. You know? Way too fucking prosperous for our own good. Way too fucking prosperous. Americans have been bought off and silenced by toys and gizmos. And no one learns. Like I say, no one questions things. You remember Barbara Bush? I call her the silver douchebag. You remember her? Barbara Bush. She is the mother of Governor George Bush. I call him Governor Bush because that's the only elected office he ever held legally in our country, okay? George Bush, Governor Bush. Yeah. I don't care where they hang his portrait. I don't care how big his library is. He'll always be Governor Bush. I don't even capitalize his name when I type it anymore. So she's the mother of Governor George Bush. She's also the wife of his father, George H.W. Bush, who did become president in the normal, legal, traditional manner. And when he did, she came along for the ride as first lady. And that's been the tradition up till now. A man has been elected, and the woman has come along for the ride as the first lady. And usually, as in American life in general, the woman is condescended to, patronized, given something to do to keep her busy. A lot of times they give her a charity or a cause, something she can champion. Betty Ford was told to drink. Remember that? You remember that? That's right. Betty Ford was told, "You drink, Betty. Betty, you drink and get really fucked up, okay?" Just get totally fallen down, fucked up, drunk, shit-faced, and blow your liver out. Blow your fucking liver out, honey. Then we'll hose you down and we'll put you in a place and get you well there and put your name on the place and Liza Minnelli can get well and everything's going to be okay. You know what I mean? So, that was her assignment. That was her assignment. Barbara Bush's assignment was getting children to read. Remember that? Getting children to read. They figured she had had so much success with George. That she would be a natural to get children to read, which misses the point completely. Not important to get children to read. Children who want to read are going to read. Kids who want to learn to read are going to learn to read. Much more important to teach children to question what they read. Children should be taught to question everything. To question everything they read, everything they hear. Children should be taught to question authority. Parents never teach their children to question authority because parents are authority figures themselves and they don't want to undermine their own bullshit inside the household. So they stroke the kid and the kid strokes them and they all stroke each other and they all grow up all fucked up and they come to shows like this.